This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Dr. Matt Caperline, I have a little intro here. I'm going to tell the people of the No Bed Dogs podcast a little bit about who you are. Okay. But you are one of the leading scientists in world study on how dogs age and how we can help them live longer, healthier, happier lives. You also co-founded the Dog Aging Project, and it's one of the largest studies ever done on dogs, tracking tens of thousands of dogs across their lifetime to learn what truly affects their lifespan and health span. And your research looks at diet, exercise, stress, environment, genetics, and even medication, like rapamycin, that extends dogs' healthier years, may extend dogs' healthier years. Right. So you do a lot of stuff. I was reading about you. I did my research last night, and I was listening to some of your stuff this morning. You are quite the scholar. You have a lot of different degrees. You've won awards. Do you work for college currently, or you worked with?
Yeah, so I have an affiliate appointment at the University of Washington still. I've left my full-time position there to start a company called OptiSpan, which is very much about trying to apply many of the same lessons that we learned when I was in academia in the real world for human health. So I really focus these days on practical, pragmatic ways to enhance health span for both companion animals and for people.
Yeah, I was reading some of your I was gone on your Instagram, and I was reading some of the stuff you've done and a lot of the talks that you've done. You've done summits and seminars, and I am very welcome to the No Bad Dogs podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What we do is I am a dog nerd, and we started this podcast, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, and it really in the beginning was just me consulting with clients, behavioral consultations. And then I said, well, I post videos on YouTube about dog training. I said, what if I just took my online consults, you just book me for like an hour, you know? And I said, I recorded the audio and just put it out. But now we've grown into just an overall dog podcast. It's the number one dog training podcast in the world, and slowly becoming probably, hopefully, the goal would be just the number one dog podcast in the world. And selfishly, I've just kind of grabbing the reins and said, you know what? Behavioral stuff's nice. We're going to still do that. But I really want to learn more about dogs. And so it gives me an opportunity to be a student. And we've had oncologists. We've had, obviously, trainers. We've had a bunch of different PhDs in animal welfare and biology. And so I'm always just on the search of how to better the relationship with our dog. And in your case, how to help them potentially, because we gotta be careful about what we say, right?
Sure.
Make them live longer, force them to live longer, the options. So tell me about the Dog Aging Project, because that's really what kind of sparked my interest as I was looking for different people to have on. So tell me and the people about that fun project.
Sure. And maybe just to lay the foundation, I should say I'm a dog person. I've had dogs my entire life. I think very much like you. I feel like my dogs are part of my family, always have. I've been very fortunate to have a couple of dogs who were particularly special to me. And it was one of those dogs. He was a German Shepherd named Dobby. We lost him about a year ago. He was really the inspiration for the Dog Aging Project. And so my background in science is I've always, since graduate school, studied the biology of aging. So trying to understand what are the factors that influence why different individuals, why different animals age at different rates. Of course, aging in the biology of aging is the greatest risk factor for most of the major causes of death and disability in humans and in dogs. And I think it's useful to appreciate dogs age biologically faster than people do. This is this idea of one human year is about 7 dog years. That's just another way of saying dogs age biologically faster than humans do, about 7 times faster. We can dive into that if you want to, because it's not linear. meaning that it's not always 7x. It changes throughout the life course, but on average, it's about 7 times faster. So I look at health through that lens, that age is what drives certainly loss of health span and most of the things that limit lifespan. And so it was about 12 years ago or so that I had this kind of light bulb moment where, you know, in my lab at the University of Washington, we'd been studying different ways we could slow aging in laboratory animals in mice, which are about the closest we can get to humans in the laboratory. We had 3 or 4 or 5 ways that we could make the mice live 30 to 40% longer, and they don't get diseases until later in life. They're healthier. So I knew it was possible to slow aging in mice, and I had this light bulb moment where I was like, well, some of these things that work in mice are going to work in dogs, because I'd seen in my lab we could slow aging using the same approaches, starting with very, very simple, even single-celled organisms, all the way up through mice. So as you know, confident as I could be about anything as a scientist, I'd say 99.5% confidence, some of these things that work in mice are going to work in dogs. And it really was a light bulb moment because, you know, I vividly remembered, I was like, oh my God, we can slow aging in dogs. We know enough today to probably do that. And there's no doubt in my mind that we can accomplish that. And so when I had that realization that, you know, I believed that we as a field could slow aging by 20%, 30% in dogs, make them live 20, 30% longer in better health, keep them from getting the diseases of aging for longer, it was something I had to do. So I immediately set out to figure out, you know, how do we do this scientifically? How do we design a clinical trial? What do we test? How do we get money to pay for it? And that was really the genesis of the dog aging project. This was 2014 or so. So working with my colleagues, Daniel Promislo and Kate Creevy, who are the other co-founders of the Dog Aging Project, you know, we really started trying to build this thing to last for, you know, a decade, 15 years, the full life course of a typical dog. Mm. And so we really set out to do two things. One is to understand what is biological aging in dogs, what are the most important genetic and environmental factors that influence health during aging in dogs. And that's really where Daniel and Katie have put a lot of their effort designing this observational study, which is most of the Dog Aging Project's large observational study of aging in dogs. My interest is doing something about it. I want to make dogs live longer, healthier. And so then I've spent a lot of time trying to design this clinical trial of rapamycin, which you alluded to, which is really to ask the question, does rapamycin slow aging in dogs? Does it increase lifespan and health span in dogs? We know it does in mice in the laboratory. Mm. And so we're in the middle of that clinical trial right now. So it's really the two components of the Dog Aging Project. What is aging in dogs? What are the things that influence aging in dogs? These are all dogs living with their owners, too. I want to be clear about that. These are not dogs in a kennel in the laboratory. These are dogs living in the real world with their owners. What does aging look like? What are the most important factors? And then can we do something about it? Can we slow aging in dogs? And I still believe today, I mean, I have no doubt, slowing aging in our companion animals is possible. It's actually not that hard. It's a resource allocation problem. And if we put enough resources towards it, we will accomplish it.
Yeah, because it's not like a lot of the human foundations and budgets, I'm assuming, you know, the budgets for human everything, research in general, yeah, the studies, the science, longevity, health, wellness, there's probably not a lot of money allocated for dogs at all.
Yeah, I mean, that has been a challenge for sure, getting the Dog Aging Project funded. It took about 5 years from that light bulb moment for me before we got the first grant from NIH. Mm. Certainly part of that is NIH is the National Institutes of Health. It's the largest U.S. federal funder of biomedical research. And their mandate is really to improve human health. It doesn't say anything about companion animal health. So
you could argue, though, that if we improve the health and longevity of our dogs,
absolutely
help humans.
Yeah, no, I think again, there are really two arguments that we made, and we did eventually get funding, at least for the first 5 years. One argument is that by studying aging in dogs, because the biology of aging is shared very much across the animal kingdom. Mm. So what we learn about aging in a mouse, will be similar to aging in a dog, will be similar to aging in a human. Not identical, but very, very close. So what we learn about aging in dogs will have value for understanding human aging and eventually being able to target human aging and slow aging in humans. And I think, as you were alluding to, the statistics tell us more than half of companion animal owners consider their companion animal to be part of their family. If we can make people's family members live longer, healthier lives, that's a good thing. There's intrinsic value in doing that, both for the companion animal and for the human. So those are the arguments we made. And again, it wasn't an easy road. It never is when you're trying to get funding for research. But we did manage to get the first grant at the end of 2018. And that allowed us to really build the infrastructure that we've got today.
That's awesome. So what's the deal with rapamycin? What is... I was listening to another podcast that you have done recently, and that's the first time I've even heard that word.
Sure.
So what is that being used in mice and how we can use it potentially in dogs, or are you using it in dogs?
Yeah, so rapamycin is a small molecule. It's a drug that is produced by bacteria. It was discovered on Easter Island, which also goes by the name Rapa Nui. That's where the drug gets its name from, rapamycin. So it's produced by bacteria in the soil on Rapa Nui. And it's been studied for, 40 or 50 years in the scientific literature for a variety of uses. Now, sort of by happenstance or just the way these things evolve, it was first tested clinically to prevent organ transplant rejection. And it was approved by the FDA more than 20 years ago.
Wow.
as an immunosuppressant to prevent organ transplant rejection. It's not actually a true immunosuppressant, but it modulates the immune system. And so in combination with other immunosuppressants, it can help people who get a kidney transplant or a heart transplant keep that transplanted organ. So that's both good and bad. It's good because we know a lot about rapamycin use in humans. And it may be worth saying that in that context, it's called sirolimus. Same molecule, same drug, different name. So if people hear it referred to as these two different words, it's actually the same drug, rapamycin, sirolimus. Okay, so we know a lot about its use in humans. We know about dosing in humans. We know about side effects in humans. Those are all at very high doses in people who've had an organ transplant or taking other drugs. But we have a lot of information about it. And it is FDA approved, which means any doctor or veterinarian can prescribe the drug, what's called off-label, if they think it's in the best interest of their patient. Okay. Mm. And then it was studied in the basic research world for a variety of different effects. Sort of accidentally, this was back in the early 2000s, four labs simultaneously discovered that rapamycin, or the protein that rapamycin inhibits, regulates aging in three different organisms. And I was one of the labs involved in that. So this happens in science sometimes that people converge on sort of a foundational or fundamental discovery. And so once that was known, and these were all simple animal models, once that was known, it was tested in mice through something called the Interventions Testing Program for its effects on lifespan in mice. And it was found you could get, in that study, about a 15% increase in average lifespan. The important thing there was they gave the drug to the mice in middle age. So these are 60-year-old equivalent mice. And they still got this large effect. Mm. And since then, my lab and many others have shown not only does rapamycin increase lifespan in mice, but it seems to delay the onset and progression of pretty much every age-related functional decline and disease that mice get, including cancer, including neurodegeneration, including dysfunction of the heart. It actually, if you give it to old mice, you can improve function in at least four different tissues and organs. So we showed in my lab you could reverse periodontal disease and periodontal aging in the oral cavity. Other people have shown you can boost age-related immune dysfunction. You can at least partially reverse ovarian senescence with aging, so reproductive senescence. You can improve heart function in an aged mouse, and some evidence for improving cognitive function. So,
wow.
It's a really appealing drug from the perspective of something you might give to a dog or a person because you can start the treatment late in life. You can at least see functional improvements in some tissues and organs. And it seems in every animal where it's been tested that it can increase both lifespan and a variety of health span metrics. So when I was, again, go back to 2014, when I was thinking about this clinical trial for dogs, you know, I had a couple of choices to for what you might test. One would be caloric restriction. That's kind of the gold standard in mice for slowing aging. When I thought about, you know, what's the likelihood we're going to get owners to calorically restrict their dog by 30, 40%, I realized that's a heavy lift. And so rapamycin was sort of the obvious other choice. The question at that point was, what do we know about rapamycin in dogs? Because we had all this data in humans, we had all this data in laboratory animals, but nobody had really been testing or studying rapamycin in dogs. And again, thinking about a clinical trial in companion animals, because many people feel about their dogs the same way that they feel about their children, you think about it very much like a pediatric clinical trial. You want to be really, really sure whatever you're testing is going to be safe, right? As a dog person, as somebody, I mean, again, you know, my incentive for designing the dog aging project, obviously I want to help dogs in general, but there was a selfish component. I wanted to help my German Shepherd live longer.
Yeah, sure.
And so I get it. You don't want to hurt anybody's dog, right? That's number one. So we had to figure out, like, what does the safety of rapamycin look like in dogs? And we were lucky in the sense that there were a couple of veterinary groups testing rapamycin at the time for oncology. One at the University of Tennessee for hemangiosarcoma of the spleen, another called the Canine Oncology Trials Consortium for osteosarcoma. And so we were able to get dosing and side effect information from those studies that allowed us to design a clinical trial where we were confident that there would be minimal side effects. And then the question is, would that dose have any effect on healthspan or lifespan in dogs? And so we're in the middle of the clinical trial. I don't know the answer to that yet.
Wow.
I can tell you a little bit about some preliminary safety trials we've done, but I really don't know, because it's still blinded, if rapamycin at the doses we're testing is going to increase lifespan and healthspan in dogs.
That is pretty groundbreaking. It's hard to wrap my head around that this new thing could actually help our dogs live not only a longer life, but a potentially even a healthier life. So how many years are you into this dosage in this trial? How many dogs are you doing it with?
Yeah. So first thing I'll say, and I'll tell you all about what we've done so far, is it's even more exciting than that, because if rapamycin doesn't work, it's not our only shot on goal. So one of the things that I recognized when I first set out to design this clinical trial was, you have to do the trial before you know whether it's going to work, right? And it might not. But I believe that by showing that this could be done, it would create a template that others could follow. And now we're actually seeing that. So there's a company called Loyal that has two drugs that they're moving through the FDA approval pipeline. And that's one thing that's worth saying. The Dog Aging Project, completely nonprofit, academic. We're not looking for FDA approval for rapamycin for dogs. Loyal is moving through the traditional FDA pipeline with two drugs that target aging in sort of overlapping but distinct ways from rapamycin. And I believe they will get what's called conditional FDA approval probably early part of next year, 2026, for one of their drugs to slow aging in dogs. So that's all just to say this is happening. It will happen. Again, this is a resource allocation problem. We could, I believe.
For you mean? Resource?
For everyone, for the field. You know, again, obviously, I'm motivated and inspired to do this kind of work. But big picture, I don't care if it's me or the Dog Aging Project or someone else. I want to see these medicines that can improve healthspan and lifespan for our companion animals be tested, rigorously shown to work, and come to market. So
yeah,
this is a field-wide problem where if we put sufficient resources towards this problem, we would solve it. Now, I'm not talking about making dogs live forever. I'm talking about, I'm highly confident that we can get 25 to 30% increases in healthy longevity for the average dog, average companion animal. There will be individual differences, as there always are.
Wow.
We know enough about the biology now. And just to put a number on it, like, this is, I don't know what it would take, but I'm guessing $200, $300 million is the at the field level, the resource allocation needed to do this. If we did that, we'd probably have more than one intervention that could slow aging in dogs. And that may seem like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. And on the other hand, the budget for NIH is in the 30s of billions of dollars every year. So it's a tiny fraction of that budget to slow aging in our companion animals. To me, this was a no-brainer 12 years ago. It's still a no-brainer now. Like, the value of doing that for everybody who loves their dogs is so immense that we should, as a society, allocate those resources. And it's somewhat frustrating to me that that hasn't happened yet. Nonetheless, I am encouraged by the fact that there are now others who are taking this path, going through the, you know, typical for-profit pipeline to get
Loyal.
FDA approval.
Who's Loyal? What company's that?
Yeah, so that's the name of the company. They're based out of San Francisco, and they have, as I mentioned, two molecules that they are moving through the FDA pipeline. One of them is targeting a pathway called insulin-like growth factor 1. Again, we can do a little bit deeper dive on this if you want to. It's actually insulin-like growth factor 1 that underlies the body size difference primarily in dogs. And as I'm sure you know, and many of your viewers will recognize, big dogs age faster than small dogs. Their lifespan is shorter, and they seem to develop most of the functional declines and diseases of aging faster than small dogs do. The largest genetic variant underlying body size in dogs is this insulin-like growth factor 1. So their rationale is that by targeting that, they can slow biological aging, at least in big dogs, and give big dogs a few extra years of healthy life. So it's a plausible argument. They haven't shown it yet, but there is data in mice supporting it. It's a reasonable approach. So anyways, they're fully focused on dogs right now. I think their, you know, larger ambitions are also to get some of these medicines into humans, but they recognize that because dogs age 7 to 10 times faster than people do, they can do the clinical trials for longevity or for age-related health span metrics in dogs much faster than you could do those clinical trials in humans.
Wow, that's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is. It's kind of hard for me because I've been in this space for so long that to me it's completely intuitive and obvious that we can and should do this, right? But for people who aren't in the science or deep in the weeds around longevity science, I get it's almost a paradigm shift to realize that aging is a biological process and it's modifiable. We can speed it up and slow it down, and we still, our understanding of biological aging is very rudimentary. I certainly do not want to suggest that we figured it all out. But I think we know enough. In fact, I know we know enough to target certain aspects of aging and slow the aging process in animals and probably in people to give, as I said, 10 to 20% added healthy lifespan. I think higher end, 20%, maybe even higher in dogs, lower end, 10% maybe in people.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty profound thinking, you know, from a dog lover standpoint, to say that we're on the cusp and the verge and the train is moving towards the idea that there's something out there. Now, would you consider rapamycin something to be natural? Is that a...
I mean, it is. It is a natural product in the sense that it's produced in the natural environment. It's not a natural molecule in our bodies. As I mentioned, it's produced by this bacteria on Easter Island. But it is definitely a natural molecule. There are derivatives of rapamycin that have been chemically modified, but rapamycin itself is found in the real world, yeah.
Because it seems like it happens organically, like in this, is it in soil?
Yeah.
You pull it from the soil?
Yeah, so what was done was there was an expedition to Easter Island 50 plus years ago, and they went there actually because they thought that there might be medicinal molecules produced by microorganisms on the island. It turns out that the natives of Rapa Nui, at least back then, often went barefoot but didn't get tetanus. And so the idea was maybe there was something in the soil that was protecting them from getting tetanus. So they went there, they collected soil samples, they were brought back to the United States and Canada, analyzed, and this molecule was found, and then they realized it was being produced by this specific bacterium in the soil. So they cultured the bacteria, made lots of the molecule, and then started testing it for all sorts of different effects on cells. And again, this was, you know, a multi-decade. It's actually a fascinating backstory. I'd encourage people to check it out. It involves like the pharmaceutical company shelving the project. The scientist, the lead scientist, took the vials home, kept them in his freezer for 10 years, took the drug himself. He claims that it kept him from dying from this cancer that he had. And then the pharmaceutical company merged with another company. He brought them back into the lab, started studying them, and then it got to the approval for organ transplant rejection. So it's a fascinating molecule. The history is really interesting. And then, as I mentioned, you know, this all happened completely independent of research on aging biology. Again, it was sort of a happy accident that four of us, four different groups, kind of stumbled on rapamycin and mTOR. That's the protein that rapamycin inhibits, all in the early 2000s. And that sort of led to, over the next, you know, 15 years, the establishment of rapamycin and mTOR as sort of central regulators of aging biology.
That is fascinating. That's exciting. I'm really happy that you guys are out there doing that, because that's way over everyone's head, I think. It's like, whoa.
It's exciting. It's also, you know, honestly, it's frustrating, sometimes a little bit demoralizing how hard it's been. You know, so I'll tell you a little bit about the studies we've done so far. So again, it was really 2014 when I realized that this had to be done. Like, we can slow aging in dogs. Somebody has to do it. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
It took, as I said, 5 years to get the first grant to do that. So I was fortunate that I had some resources available to me through the university that I could allocate, you know, wherever I wanted, basically. And so I used those to fund our first clinical trial, which was a very small safety study. We only treated for 10 weeks. And again, we were really doing this to just prove that we could do it, that we could design the trial, that dog owners would participate, because that was unknown. Nobody had ever done this kind of a thing before. Again, through sort of happy accidents, we got a lot of media attention before we'd even started the trial. So I was being interviewed by a reporter for Nature News. Nature is one of the premier scientific journals, about something completely different. And I was telling her about this idea, and that you know, I thought we had an opportunity to test whether rapamycin could slow aging in dogs. She got so excited about that. She wrote a short story in Nature about that. It got picked up by, I think, the UK Guardian, and then the Seattle Times wanted to write a story on it, our hometown paper. And so it was kind of funny, because we, you know, the reporter came out and interviewed me and Daniel Promislow. I know it was a Thursday or a Wednesday. And then said, okay, this is going to be in, I think it was the Sunday edition of the paper and on the website. And I'm sitting at home with my wife on a Friday night, and we're talking to each other about this, and we're like, you know, as soon as this article comes out, we're going to have a lot of people who want to participate in this clinical trial, potentially. We don't have any way for them to request participation. She's like, well, we should build a website. And I'm like, oh, yeah, we should. So she built a website over the weekend, and she's like, what do you want to call this thing? And I'm like, oh, man, I don't know. It's aging, it's dogs. Why don't we call it the Dog Aging Project? And so that's how we started the thing. We put the website up literally on like Saturday, Sunday. And then the article came out, and then we had probably 300-400, maybe more people asked to participate in the clinical trial by middle of the next week. And so that's when I knew, okay, it didn't surprise me. Like, I knew people would want this, but that people are really willing to participate in a scientific project to improve the health of their companion animals. And all they need to do is know it's possible, right? And so we carried out the first phase clinical trial at a veterinary clinic, specialty veterinary clinic north of Seattle. We only had 24 dogs in that study. 8 were placebo. And all of our clinical trials are randomized placebo-controlled clinical trials. We're doing this to the highest possible standards. Good. Because we feel like, you know, if this works or if it doesn't, right, it's really important that people know that this is being done properly. So everything's randomized, placebo-controlled. 8 dogs got the placebo. 8 got a low dose of rapamycin. 8 got a higher dose. It's not a high dose, but a higher dose, so double the dose. And again, it was mostly safety. So we, every week, asked the owners if they had noticed any side effects in their dogs. We got blood work at the beginning, middle, and end of the 10-week period. And then because, as I alluded to earlier, we knew that rapamycin could improve heart function in aged mice, we gave the dogs echocardiograms. So it's an ultrasound for the heart the beginning and at the end. And fortunately, what we saw was no difference in side effects between the placebo and the two rapamycin groups. When we pooled the two rapamycin groups, 2 of the 3 primary endpoints for heart function were statistically significantly better in the dogs that got rapamycin compared to the dogs that got the placebo. The third one was going the right direction. It didn't meet statistical significance. So given that this was a small study, it wasn't designed to be statistically powered for that endpoint, we felt like this was pretty good evidence that rapamycin in dogs is probably having a beneficial effect on age-related changes in heart function. And it's important to say, these aren't dogs with heart failure. These are declines in heart function within the normal range, but it's declines that you see with aging in specifically left ventricular function. So that was very encouraging. The other thing that came out of that study was, based on owner reports, the dogs were more active and had better quality of life. So, you know, that got the rapamycin. And the owners didn't know if their dogs were getting rapamycin or placebo when they were filling out these weekly reports. So again, not definitive by any stretch of the imagination, but encouraging. So then we went on, and we were able to get a reasonably nice grant from a foundation called the Donner Foundation, after the New York Times picked up the story about our first study, that funded a six-month trial at Texas A&M University. Very similar design, just longer. And again, no evidence for side effects. One dog got high triglycerides, and that's a known side effect of rapamycin in people. So there's probably a genetic connection there where rare genetic variants, when taking rapamycin at these doses, will increase triglycerides. That's not such a concern in dogs because dogs don't typically get vascular disease the way people do. And also, all of the known side effects with rapamycin in humans stop when you stop taking the medication. So the dog completed the 6 months, came off the drug, and the triglycerides went back down. So other than that, no side effects, no difference between placebo and rapamycin treatment. And again, in the owner self-reported documentation, the owners reported an increase in activity and improved quality of life. So directionally, the same way as the 10-week study. And again, we felt very confident after that, that at least in terms of side effects, this was safe, and we could move to a larger clinical trial. So that's what we're doing now. That clinical trial, as I mentioned, the grant for that trial was funded in late 2018. And that grant also supported the larger observational study. So most of 2019 was spent building the infrastructure to enroll dogs into both of those, into both the observational study and the clinical trial. We got to November 2019, sort of did a soft launch, went public that we're trying to recruit dogs into these things. And then, of course, we'll all remember what happened in early 2020 with COVID-19. Mm-hmm. All the veterinary clinics shut down for anything that wasn't, you know, sort of emergency critical services. And so we made the strategic decision to kind of back off on enrolling into the rapamycin clinical trial because the veterinary clinics weren't able to do it anyways, and focus on building the observational study. So throughout 2020, 2021, we grew that study to over 30,000 dogs, and now it's over 50,000. So these are 50,000 dogs and owners participating in the dog aging project around the United States now. And we didn't really start trying hard to recruit dogs into the rapamycin trial until, I would say, mid-2022. And so at this point, we've got, it's well over 200 dogs in that clinical trial. Our goal is to get 580 dogs into the clinical trial. We had a gap in funding, and again, this is part of the frustration that I sometimes feel with the way that resources are allocated and grants are considered. So we had a gap in funding between 2023 and the early part of 2025. That grant has since been refunded, so now we've got all the clinical sites online. We're enrolling. If people are interested in either the observational or the rapamycin clinical trial, I encourage people to go to dogagingproject.org. You click nominate my dog, and that's it. Any dog, any size, any age, any breed can participate in the observational study. The rapamycin clinical trial is restricted to dogs that are at least 7 years old, and they have to be between, I think, 40 and 110 pounds. And there's the age and size is just so that we have the statistical power to see improvements in health span or lifespan. So that trial is about half enrolled. I'm hopeful it will be fully enrolled within the next 18 months. I really, I've gotten gun shy about giving timelines because stuff happens, but I hope that'll happen. And I think at our current rate, it will. And then the dogs get the drug for 1 year.
How are they?
Or the placebo. It's a pill. Owners give it to them once a week, and we track compliance. So we
once
know.
Once a week?
Yep, once a week.
Wow.
Yep. And it can be with food, so you just put the pill in the food. It's funny, you know, this is a little bit of an aside, but I give talks on the Dog Aging Project fairly frequently, and one of the common things I hear is, why aren't you doing this for cats? You know, cat people are like, I want my cat to live longer, and I get it. And I'm like, well, we're giving the drug as a pill, and have you ever tried to give a pill to a cat?
Right. So, that's true.
So it's pretty easy with dogs, especially big dogs. And owners, we found owners have not had any trouble giving the medication to their dogs. So dogs get the medication once a week for a year, and then there's a 2-year follow-up with veterinary exams every 6 months. So we get pretty high quality data, what we call longitudinally, which means over time, on all of the dogs in the clinical trial. Lifespan is the primary endpoint, and we believe that we are statistically powered to detect a 9% change in lifespan, which is the low end of what's been seen in mice. But of course, you know, we're really interested in health span, so we're measuring as many health span related metrics as we can. So, you know, activity, cognitive assessments, heart function, neurological function, disease incidence. To ask the question, you know, maybe rapamycin won't increase lifespan, but if it improves health span and pushes the diseases of aging back, that's a win too. So we're trying to measure as many of those things as we can. So all of that's to say that if we're successful in getting all of the dogs enrolled in 18 months, all of the dogs will have completed the treatment period by 2.5 years from now. And so we'll do what's called an interim analysis at that point. We probably won't be able to say anything about lifespan because we think we need that whole 3-year window to say anything about lifespan. But we may be able to make some inferences about different health span metrics at that point. And then the study will finish in you know 3 years from when the last dog is enrolled. And I should say, because of the way the study has rolled out and how long it's been going, we've had dogs go all the way through. So we've had, I don't know what the number is, but probably at least dozen plus, maybe more, dogs that have what the team calls graduated from the clinical trial, meaning dog got the full year of either placebo or rapamycin and then 2 years of follow-up and has now come out of the study. Of course, we're going to continue to stay in touch with the owners and find out what happens, but they are formally done with the clinical trial at this point. So it's a rolling process. And, you know, fingers crossed, we'll get all the dogs enrolled in the next 18 months, and then it'll just be a matter of finishing out the treatment and follow-up period.
So right now, you said that you're starting to see an increase in longevity. Is that what you said? And so what are you able to see? I know that you said you're seeing decrease in cancers and diseases potentially.
In mice.
Yeah. And right now, you have to wait for the full study to be done to really tell. So
for dogs
yeah. to see if it is
that's right.
doing the same thing.
That's right. So the way that we can assess whether there's a change in lifespan, let's just start with lifespan, requires us to have all of the dogs finish the study, because right now it's what's called blinded, meaning I don't know, the veterinarians don't know, the owners don't know. There's only one person who is in charge of the randomization schedule, who knows which dogs are getting placebo and which dogs are getting rapamycin. So we can't ask the question, did the dogs that get rapamycin live longer, until two things happen. And one of the kind of sad things to think about when you're doing a clinical trial like this is the only way you can see an increase in lifespan is if in the placebo group, a significant fraction of the dogs die, right? So that's why we're starting with middle-aged, larger dogs,
right.
because they're aging.
That makes sense.
Faster. Yeah. So a significant fraction of the dogs have to die, and that takes time. That's why that 3-year period is there. And then we have to be able to unblind, right, so that we can separate the dogs that got rapamycin from the dogs that got placebo and ask, did the dogs that got rapamycin live longer? So that's why I won't be able to say most likely anything about lifespan until all of the dogs have completed the 3-year period, because that's when we'll be able to unblind and also have the statistical power to see an effect if it's there.
Right. Wow, that is a lot to unpack. That is very exciting. So what would happen if you guys got to the end of the clinical study in 3+ years, once all the dogs are in? Because you guys are doing it for nonprofit.
Yeah.
So would a company come in and take the studies that you've done and then they push it through with the money they have for profit for FDA?
Right. So one of the things that's interesting about rapamycin is because it's already FDA approved, there is no requirement for a company to get what's called a label indication, which would mean, so what that means is FDA would say this drug is approved for this specific use. That's what the indication is, for this specific indication. Mm-hmm. So if somebody wanted to, they could spend the, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, whatever it would take to get a label indication for rapamycin for lifespan at that point. But it's not necessary because it's already FDA approved. Any veterinarian today can prescribe rapamycin for a dog or a cat or any other companion animal if they believe that doing so is in the best interest of their client. Mm. And so I think, again, part of the reason for trying to do this to the very, very highest standards in a nonprofit setting is, first of all, because rapamycin is off patent, no drug company would do the clinical trial to get FDA approval. And by doing it to the highest standards, the hope is that if the effect is convincing, right, if it's a 20% effect on lifespan, let's say, or a dramatic improvement in health span, that veterinarians will feel confident that this has been done to the highest clinical standards.
Right.
And be comfortable based on the safety and efficacy data that we've collected, prescribing it to their clients, right? There's no doubt that that if this works, lots of owners are going to want this for their dogs. Lots of owners already want it, right? There's already a growing community of owners who are giving rapamycin to their dogs on the hope, because based on what we know rapamycin can do in laboratory animals. So,
and how are they getting that?
Yeah, so veterinarians can prescribe it.
Okay,
so it's a matter of convincing
pharmacy or something.
Yeah, so it's a matter of convincing your veterinarian, and I'm not suggesting people do this, right? But this is what people are doing. It's a matter of convincing your veterinarian that rapamycin is safe, and there's a reasonable chance that it could improve health for your dog. And if you have a veterinarian who is willing to prescribe it, then you can get it from your local pharmacy. You get it from Amazon Pharmacy.
Wow.
Yeah, so because it is an already approved drug.
Yeah.
And I should say, I mean, you know, I don't recommend that people do this, but I gave rapamycin to my dog.
And so, what did you see?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say with any confidence that it had a large benefit for him. So he was at the time we started, middle-aged German Shepherd, suffering from some of the things that are common in German Shepherds. So, you know, a lot of hip pain originally, and some of that's driven by chronic inflammation. And so, you know, the perception was that he had less pain and was able to take lower doses of other medications for the pain when he was on rapamycin. But I can't say with 100% confidence. You know, I think we have to be honest about the bias that comes into things like this, right?
It's like perfect pill, right?
There is a placebo effect. Well, and there is a placebo effect, both in terms of, you know, when we take something ourselves and what we think we see when we give something to our companion animals. So I can't say with 100% confidence that rapamycin had any benefit for him. What I can say with a high level of confidence is rapamycin at the doses that we're testing in dogs seems to be very safe. Again, we haven't seen any significant adverse events. And in laboratory animals, across the board, slows aging, increases lifespan, improves a variety of health span metrics. The question in my mind is whether or not the doses that we are testing in dogs are too low to get the benefits that we see in laboratory animals, because we are being very, very careful about safety, as we should be. But this is always the challenge when you're trying to design a clinical trial. You have to weigh multiple factors and make educated guesses and do the best you can. So,
something that comes to mind when you're talking about this is I don't know if you've thought about this yet, but there's so many dogs every day that are getting euthanized.
Yeah.
Middle-aged, young puppies, elderly. Is that something that's crossed your mind where you say, hey, these guys are on the chopping block anyway. If we don't intervene, they're going to die today. If we got them up the dose, found a foster, found a home for them, they're...
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Happy-go-lucky dogs, easy to manage, the shelter's just full.
Yeah.
And you did the same trial, but you did it in a higher dose at the voluntary, you know, of the owner or whatever, mm-hmm. or the dog aging project could own it, whatever. Is that something that's crossed your mind, that if you didn't do it, they're dead anyway?
Yeah.
So health is not even on the table. And if you did do it and you saved the dog's life, if you up the dose, it seems like there's a good chance there's not going to be too many cons, which means the dog's not going to overdose and be lethal, it seems.
Right.
And the pros to that would be you could really see some serious data. So it's a win-win because you can see serious data of this actually working better. And then also you're saving the dog's life.
Yeah. Definitely have thought about partnering with shelters or organizations that get dogs out of shelters. I think there are some challenges with that kind of an approach. I think they're solvable. What it really comes down to is somebody's got to pay for it, right? And so that kind of a study would be impossible to get funded by the National Institutes of Health. So it would require somebody else to fund that kind of a study. And one of the things that's been maybe a little bit surprising to me is, you know, everybody thinks that it should be so easy to raise money for the dog aging project. Like, there are so many rich people out there who love their dogs. This should be really simple. It's not.
I get it. Yeah.
So I think that's really what it comes down to. I think that there is a path there that makes sense. But somebody has to be willing to put up the resources to fund that sort of a study. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. I think about that all the time. Even when we go out and we do different filming projects and saving dogs' lives and as a trainer and going in, you would just assume that everybody's going to be like, oh, you're going to go help these dogs that are dying. Everyone's going to jump on board and everything's going to be great. And it's just not. I think it's just a human thing where the idea of dogs living longer or dogs living in some cases, in my cases, from some of the things I would do, you would assume. But I just think that it's just not what people think, actually.
Yeah, and I mean, again, I sort of get it. Like, everybody is motivated by a variety of factors, and like for me personally, you know, as I've mentioned a couple of times, my primary motivation was for my own dog. Right. Again, of course, I would love to help everybody else's dogs live longer, healthier lives. But the thing that actually got me to focus and do it and build this thing was the hope that I could help my German Shepherd live longer. And again, just as a little bit of an aside, you know, we lost him a year ago, and it was probably the hardest thing I've ever experienced in my life. And I realized, you know, I felt a lot of guilt that I didn't help him live longer. Right. So, and I still do. And I know that's not rational, but it's like, I know the path to do this for dogs. And I wasn't able to get it done soon enough for him. And that still hurts. Mm. And it really frustrates me, because I think that we have an immense opportunity here to give millions of companion animals. And I say that dogs for sure, but this is not going to be unique to dogs, right? Longer, healthier lives. And so, you know, if anybody's listening that you know, has the resources and wants to help, there is a path. And again, whether that's done through the Dog Aging Project or through a for-profit company, it doesn't really matter. But we should get it done because we know enough to do it.
Yes, it seems like it's a clear path. It's an easy formula to say, hey, no questions asked. Objectively, 1 + 1 is going to equal 2. We just need the resources.
Right. And again, you know, I believe that rapamycin will have health span effects in dogs, and if we can find the right dose, probably will increase lifespan in dogs. But I don't know with 100% certainty. What I can say with a much higher degree of certainty, close to 100%, is that we know other things that can slow aging in laboratory animals. Some of these things are going to work in dogs, and it's really just the biology of aging is so conserved That is going to happen. And it's just a matter of doing the clinical trials, finding the right doses, finding the right balance of safety and efficacy. And so we built the template. Like, we can do this. And there are enough people out there who want to participate in these kinds of clinical trials. It's just a matter of building them. And all that, that just takes resources. Yeah. That's it.
That's fascinating. That's really incredible. Outside of the rapamycin, what are some other things that you've been finding in your work that can help dogs live a healthier, happier life? Things that can help with cancers and the maturing of dogs, and what, because I know that you do a lot with humans too as well.
Yeah.
So what are some other things? Diet, environments, breed, temperament. What are some other things that you're finding?
Right. So I should say the rest of the dog aging project, the observational study, is purely correlative, right? Meaning we are not asking the owners to change anything that they're doing with their dogs. We are simply collecting information on the dogs. Most of that information is in the form of owner-reported survey data, environmental factors, health history, diet, exercise, sleep, cognitive function assessments. And then we also get medical records from the veterinarians. And for a subset of the dogs, we get genetics, we get other sort of molecular biology features, metabolome, epigenome, microbiome, blood chemistry. But all of that's to say, because we're not, it's not a clinical trial, we're not asking the owners to give their dogs anything different, it's a hypothesis-generating study, meaning we can say A is associated with B, but we can't say A causes B. Mm. And so by its nature, I try to be conservative in my interpretation. So I can tell you some of the associations we've seen, and I think in some cases, it is so plausible that it's almost obvious that there is a mechanistic connection that owners can act on. But by its nature, the data is not causal. Okay, so we've looked at a variety of stuff. I think one thing people are very interested in, one of the things that surprised me, we've had two things that surprised me around diet. So one has to do with how often owners feed their dogs. I'm sure you've heard of intermittent fasting, like it's a big thing that lots of people are excited about. And so I have felt for a long time that a lot of the intermittent fasting information that's out there is hype more than reality. So when you actually look at the scientific literature, intermittent fasting in and of itself has little to no effect on health or longevity. Intermittent fasting, and this is in laboratory animals, intermittent fasting paired with caloric restriction increases lifespan and can improve health span metrics. So all that's to say, if you intermittent fast, but you still eat as much as you normally would, it's probably not doing much for you.
Yeah, they equal out.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, but you know, that's not the typical, what you'll hear on a lot of the influencer noise that's out there. So it occurred to me, dogs are a really interesting place where we could look at whether or not how many meals a dog eats in a day is associated with health outcomes.
Yeah.
And so, and we had all that data in our data set. So we asked a very simple question. Were dogs that are fed once a day more or less likely to have been diagnosed with, I think, 10 different age-related conditions we looked at across many different organs and tissues? And, you know, based on what I just said, I didn't think we'd see anything. I was like, oh, there's nothing to intermittent fasting. I was wrong. In every case, all 10, directionally, the dogs fed once a day had a lower risk of having been diagnosed with that condition. And wow. In, I think, 7 of the cases, it was statistically significant. So I've been in biology a long time. That's a real signal. It means something. One interpretation is that intermittent fasting in dogs slows aging, or at least protects against a variety of age-related diseases. Another alternative hypothesis is that dogs fed once a day are less likely to be obese. And we know obesity is a driver for multiple age-related diseases, and probably itself, if paired with metabolic dysfunction, accelerates biological aging. So now we have to go on and do the follow-up experiments to try to tease those two out. My intuition is this is more of an obesity metabolic health thing than it is just intermittent fasting. But we have to do the experiment and find out. One thing I would say is if you have an older dog and you've been feeding that dog 3 times a day, I wouldn't suddenly go to once a day feeding. And I would say, if your dog's obese, like, that's on you. You can fix that problem, and you should, because it's not good for your dog's health. And we'll figure out whether or not once-a-day feeding in and of itself has benefits in dogs. But it's a certainly an intriguing hypothesis-generating experiment that suggests we should go do more deeper research to see if there's a there. The other thing around diet that surprised me was, you know, there's a lot of opinions out there about what the best diet is for dogs. There are people who are evangelical online about, you know, raw food diets, home-cooked diets, kibble's terrible, kibble's great. So again, we could look in our data set and at least, again, observationally ask the question, given what the dogs are being fed, is there any association with age-related health outcomes? And so we compared to traditional kibble to raw fed to cooked home diet. And at that level, and obviously you could get much more granular than that, but at that level, no signal. So that sort of surprised me. I thought we would see a difference between the dietary compositions, and we didn't. So again, doesn't mean that there isn't a best diet, or that if you knew enough, you couldn't identify the best diet for a given dog. I think what it means is the other factors, like is your dog obese, have a larger effect on health than what it is that they're eating.
Sure.
So that was interesting. We've also looked at relationships with cognitive function and seen some interesting things. So one interesting thing there, again, which surprised me, is, you know, I mentioned that big dogs age faster than small dogs. And that seems to be true everywhere in the body, except maybe in the brain. So again, people may or may not realize this, but something like 15% of dogs will develop dementia. It's called canine cognitive dysfunction. And we assess cognitive function annually in our cohort. So with other age-related diseases, cancers, for example, big dogs at every age are at higher risk of getting cancer than small dogs are. Not for dementia. And if anything, big dogs might be a little bit protected from dementia. Tiny, tiny effect if it's real. But they're not getting it at a faster rate. That seems to match what we see in people. So you can't see the difference in aging rate in humans as easily because we don't have the body size difference that dogs do.
Right.
But big people, and I'm not talking obesity, I'm talking stature, so height is probably the easiest thing to think about. Big people do seem to be at higher risk for age-related diseases. If you have enough people, you can see the signal there than small people, except for dementia, which is interesting. So that tells us that maybe there's a difference between aging in the brain and aging in the rest of the body. And this comes back to that IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1 that I mentioned that controls body size in dogs. The other things that are associated with dementia in dogs, though, age is number 1. That makes sense. Exercise is number 2. So this is a very pragmatic. It makes sense, right? We know in people that an absence of exercise is going to be associated with a variety of age-related diseases, including dementia. That seems to be the case in dogs. So there, the answer is make sure your dog gets exercise, right? Which, again, is sort of obvious, but
yeah.
But people, I think, need to hear it, right? Because that's a really actionable thing that you can do, is take your dog for a walk. Oh, and by the way, it's good for you too, right?
Is that do you think that that's related to a cardiovascular system? Because it's the same studies that I've been, after having kids, I've been trying to figure out how to live as long as I possibly can myself.
Yeah.
So I've been all down the biohacking avenues.
Oh yeah.
I'm just doing all the things.
We could do a deep dive on that too.
So, well, I did, and I have, and I'm wondering, because of all the studies, because I got a sauna now, because I've seen this. Sauna is just great for many reasons, but one of the real reasons why I spent the money on the dang thing is because of all the Scandinavian researchers that have gone to show all of the different things that sauna can do for you and your mortality and the dementia decline and people who regularly use the sauna. And I'm just thinking, as you're saying this, because the sauna makes you sweat, makes you cardiovascular, makes your blood push, makes everything. Do you think that those two are related? If you physically exercise your dog because their heart's moving, their blood's moving, you know, they don't sweat like we do, but do you think that that's correlated?
Yeah. I mean, I think certainly it could be a heart related effect. So again, I mentioned earlier, dogs don't really get as much vascular disease as people do. So I don't know how much of it is the circulatory benefit from exercise, although I'm sure that's part of it. I suspect it's also metabolic. So again, dogs that exercise regularly are going to be less likely to be overweight and obese. They're going to be more likely to maintain joint function. And so I think it's probably more than just cardiovascular, but I'm sure that's part of it. And I'm sure that's true in people as well. It's just that in humans, we as a population, particularly given the diets that Americans eat, tend to have a much higher rate of vascular disease than we should, for sure.
So if you could define exercise for dogs, what would that be?
Yeah, I mean, again, there are a variety of ways that you can try to measure this, right? I think from my perspective, the sort of first principle is it doesn't really matter whether it's slow walks or out in a yard running around, or, you know, we could try to get into, like, is there a HIIT protocol for dogs, right? High intensity training for dogs. I think it's, you know, first principle is just move, right? And again, I think as much as you can do it with your dog, the better, right? Because it's good for you and it's good for your relationship with your companion animal. Once we get past that, I suspect there are very breed specific things going on here. As you know, certain breeds are sort of intrinsically more prone to do certain types of exercise, herding activities, things like that. And so I feel like there's probably not a one-size-fits-all answer to what would be the optimal exercise protocol for your dog. It's going to be somewhat dependent on breed, somewhat dependent on personality.
Age, too, I'd say.
And age, yeah. And I mean, I think this is one thing that is maybe worth mentioning. As we start to get medicines that are more effective at attenuating pain, and there are some good ones that have come on the market, people do need to be careful that if you have an older dog who has been experiencing quite a bit of pain and that's been limiting their mobility, and suddenly you give them one of these medications that blunts that pain, you don't necessarily want to let them go out and start, you know, doing agility exercises because they're more likely to injure themselves.
Right.
So paying attention to, right, the overall health status and age of your dog and what you allow the dog to do when it comes to physical activity is important. So, again, I think first principles, spend time with your dog walking if you can. And, again, it's complicated because it depends on where you live and you know, what your daily routine is. But to the extent you can, take your dog for walks. If you have a backyard, having the dog free roam in the backyard is a great way. Some dogs will exercise, some dogs won't. And that's going to be somewhat personality dependent based on the dog.
Yeah, because that's always something that I think dog owners will hear, obviously, is exercise your dog. I always tell people about the difference between mental and physical exercise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I think what you're going to allude to there is environmental enrichment, right? And giving them activities that will challenge their mental state, mental capacity. That's also true in people, by the way. So, you know, a lack of environmental enrichment is associated with cognitive decline and dementia. The third thing on the list after exercise was eye and neurological disorders were associated with dementia in dogs. This is
eye,
hearing. This is probably because, and we see this in people as well, when the dogs are not seeing well, not hearing well, their environmental stimulation is decreased. And so it leads to an environment where they don't get as much of that mental stimulation. So I think what you were alluding to, correct me if I'm wrong, is if owners can do activities with their dogs that stimulate them mentally, that has health benefits, particularly for cognitive function, but potentially for other aspects of health as well.
Yeah, the big thing for me is behavior.
Mm-hmm, right.
So as a dog trainer / behaviorist / whatever you want to call me, somebody who specializes in dog behavior, people bring me in all sorts of cases, right? Sometimes it's a neurotic, sometimes it's a bored. But the number one thing that I tell people is, you know, for example, we see a lot of drivey dogs, shepherds, right? The Australian shepherds, the border collies, the Malinois, the German shepherds, Dutch shepherds, dogs who are in any type of dog that's historically supposed to be working, right? Mm-hmm. A dog that is supposed to be doing something. Like when they're born, especially if you get, and the interesting thing behaviorally is so many different dog breeds have different, there's like different gene pools, right? So you can get a German shepherd and they're a total couch potato.
Right.
And then you can get another German shepherd and they're relentless until they're 12, right? Just constantly play, 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 go, go, go. And so I tell people, you know, it'd be like somebody wanting to live a healthier lifestyle but not eat better or not exercise. And if you go to a nutritionist and they say, hey, I'm really looking to get healthier, but they're not willing to physically exercise, or vice versa, if they went to a physical trainer and they said, but I'm not willing to eat right, you have to have that balance to really get the full circle of change, right? And so I always, in communicating and educating to people that you may come in and I can observe the information and see what the dog is presenting through the 13 years I've been doing this professionally and tell you this is probably what's going on. But if you're not willing to go home and physically and mentally get the dog's stimulation out, and I explain to people that all dogs have different – they have two different tanks. They have the physical and then they have the mental. And so if, you know, the old saying of like a tired dog is a happy dog, and there's a lot of validity to that, but not always. But if you have a dog that goes out and physically exhausts themselves in any capacity, whether it's Frisbee or in some cases, larger dogs just need a walk around the neighborhood and they're good. And I have two different dogs. I have a very big, large protective dog. And then I have a shepherd that just their dispositions are different, but also their desires and needs are different, and they need to be met differently. So my shepherd, she's not really content, like meaning she's not sitting there going, we need to go do something, unless I really throw the Frisbee or the chuck it with her, because she just needs that physical outlet.
Right.
And it's the same thing with people. Like, all people have different kind of tanks in their systems, right? And it makes such a significant difference in the mental state of the dog if you not only go out and mentally exercise them, and again, breed specific. Sometimes it's a walk. Sometimes it's their tongue needs to be hanging out for them to sit down and go, okay, I'm good for now. wait an hour, and then they're back up.
Yeah.
But I tell people, you have to exhaust that tank, because it's the same thing with people. They come in, I'm the same way. I've been really working on my mental and physical health forever. It's always been an evolving, oh, this is different, or, you know, doing this. And so if I exercise, if I go run a couple miles, my whole day is different.
Yeah, for sure.
If I cold plunge, my whole day is different. If I sauna, my sleep's different. If I take different vitamins, if I, blah, blah, blah. I've been really kind of hacking away at what makes me feel a certain way. And it's the same thing for dogs. Yep. Is if you don't understand what your dog desired. For a perfect example is people who get a Tibetan Mastiff, which is a giant protective breed. They make awful pets, but they're great at, you know, protecting livestock, leaving them out in the yard, sleeping in the barn type thing, or getting a really high drive border collie that's just chasing the kids and nipping people. And I tell people, like, if you're not going to be successful with this dog unless you plug it in and really give it what it's desired. It's like getting a Ferrari and just parking it.
Yeah.
It just doesn't, it needs to be fulfilled in some way.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, that you have to be attuned to your dog and recognize that not all dogs are going to be the same. That can be hard with things like you mentioned, vitamins and supplements and things like that, and knowing, you know, what's working, what's not working, what should I give my dog. I think in the longevity space, unfortunately, we have seen a pretty dramatic proliferation of misinformation, and a lot of people are trying to take, you know, supplements that are being sold for humans and just repurpose them for dogs. And first of all, most of the supplements that are being sold for humans, there's not a lot of scientific data to support. And now we're seeing a lot of, you know, quote-unquote longevity supplements for dogs. So if I could give people a word of warning, I would say stay away from anything that people are selling as a longevity supplement for dogs. That's not to say no supplements are good for dogs. You probably have a core set of supplements that you believe in. But in general, the longevity-based marketing is all snake oil at this point for companion animals.
What are you seeing? That's something I was going to ask you. What are you seeing? Because I've only seen a handful of vitamins and like a multivitamin for dogs. I've only really seen a couple companies put that out there. What do you see right now in the multivitamin space for dogs? Is it increasing? Is it getting more popular? And what is real for longevity and health and overall wellness for dogs?
Yeah, so we have a large data set on supplements that owners are giving their dogs. I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's a very high percentage of people that are giving supplements to their dogs, at least in our data set. Mostly those are things like glucosamine and chondroitin, and, you know, the sort of standard kind of go-to supplements for dogs. There definitely is a growing group of companies that are trying to market in the longevity space for dogs. And again, it's possible they haven't really hit mainstream because I'm in the space, so I see all the advertisements come across my feed. And in general, what they're trying to do is take some of these supplements that, you know, have varying degrees of evidence supporting them, NAD boosters or antioxidants, other things that have been at least talked about as having an effect on aging or longevity, and repurposing them for dogs because there's no regulation preventing them from doing that. And they can get away with making at least deceptive, if not outright false claims, because nobody's really enforcing that space. So as an example, there's a company that was started by a pretty well-known scientist in the longevity space and his brother, and they started selling a supplement that contained supposedly an NAD booster and a senolytic. I don't know if that word means anything to you.
For dogs?
For dogs, yeah. But this is supposed to clear senescent cells. No evidence at all for benefits in dogs, or people for that matter, but particularly in dogs. And some evidence that, at least in aged mice, an NAD booster can cause kidney pathology. So some reason for concern. They started marketing this as a longevity drug. They put out a press release that claimed this was the first clinically proven supplement to reverse aging in dogs, which is a complete lie. It's just not true at all. Mm. And have been selling this. So
what is there? They have to have some grounds.
Well, so it's interesting. I don't know if this has changed. The labeling on the product doesn't even say what's in there. It just says NAD booster and senolytic, which I think is probably illegal, but I don't know the FDA regulations well enough to know for sure. Seems like you should have to say what the active ingredients are. Mm. So in mice, there is weak data that at least one NAD booster can increase lifespan, but that hasn't been reproducible.
What do you mean reproducible?
Meaning you've only done independent testing did not see the same effect. So a second lab or second group tried to reproduce the original result. This is nicotinamide riboside.
It did happen one time?
It was published once and then was not reproducible, yeah.
Not reproducible meaning you tried it again and it didn't work.
Right.
Got it.
Right. A different group tried it, yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. And then senolytics, you know, as a class, there are a variety of studies suggesting that, again, in mice, there could be health span benefits. The lifespan effects, again, I think most people are less encouraged by. But as a group, the idea here with senolytics is as we age, these things called senescent cells accumulate. They give off inflammatory factors. If you could kill those cells without killing healthy cells, that would be a good thing. That's the idea behind senolytics. And so there are molecules that seem to somewhat preferentially target and kill senescent cells versus healthy cells. Mm. And in mice, if you do that, you can improve at least some measures of health span, maybe lifespan a little bit. So as a concept, that's reasonable. No evidence yet limited evidence in people that this is going to have big effects. But there have been a couple of small clinical trials that are suggestive. The problem here is we don't actually know what supposed senolytic they're using. And lots of people are claiming all sorts of molecules are senolytic without any real evidence to support that. So in my view, marketing a product to dogs based on mouse data is not problematic if you are being honest about what right. you're doing and you understand what the safety profile looks like. But you should tell people what's in it. You should know something about the safety concerns. And at least in the case of the NAD booster, there are some. And you should not lie about it and say it's the first clinically proven supplement to reverse aging in dogs.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. What are some things that people could give their dogs for supplementation like that you've seen? And maybe it's not in your realm, but
yeah.
Are there anything that you've seen, vitamins, minerals, things that we can add to see some longevity with dogs?
Yeah, so nothing, I don't think there's anything that we can confidently say will boost longevity, right? And so again, this is where I'm gonna defer to the veterinary specialists on what are the right
okay.
molecules, supplements for dogs. What I would say in humans is, this is my personal perspective, we should be reasonably stringent in what we take in terms of supplements. So my view is if you can measure it and you know something about the optimal ranges, you should supplement to get into the optimal range.
Got it.
That's a pretty small set of molecules. I would say omega-3s, vitamin D, B vitamins. Once you get outside of that, there aren't a lot of things we can measure and we know what the right optimal range is to supplement into. But for those things, absolutely do it. I think in humans, creatine is the other one I would put on the list for sure, as something that has very little downside and potentially upside for many people. And then once you get outside of that, there's not a lot that I feel super confident about. So I think a lot of people take the view, and they probably do this with their dogs as well, that, well, you know, if it's likely to be safe, there's no downside, I should just give it to my dog. The problem with that is that neglects the fact that in the supplement market, because it's not really regulated, oftentimes there are other things in the supplement pill itself, fillers, things like that.
Yeah.
And when you start taking 10, 15, 20, or giving that to your companion animal, those additives build up. And sometimes there are things like iron in there or mercury or, you know, things that if you get too much,
yeah,
could actually be problematic. And so I think we don't want to go down, I would suggest, don't go down the path of just giving something because it might have a benefit. Try to do a rational risk-reward analysis for everything that you take or give to your companion animal. And it doesn't hurt to talk to a veterinarian if you've got a veterinarian that you trust and say, hey, what do you think about this? A multivitamin, probably fine. But taking a lot of different things, especially if it's branded as longevity, is probably not a good idea, because just in the act of branding it that way, they are deceiving you into thinking this has been shown to improve longevity.
Yeah, that makes sense. I just did a podcast with some people that you know that did the Dog Stable, which is like the cookbook for dogs.
Right.
It'll come out once their book comes out this year. But that was pretty interesting to see all the things that they've done. That was fascinating. Can I give you let me ask you a question.
Okay.
So to your point, and I just want to validate in my head what you're saying. Basically, don't supplement without results, without evidence of. So, what do you believe, and do you follow the any type of methylation for people?
Yes.
Okay.
So yeah. So I mean, I think, and this is where I don't know the situation in dogs. So in people, there are genetic variants that can affect your metabolism of methyl groups, right? And so for people who have that genetic variant, it often makes sense to supplement.
Yeah.
Again, should everybody supplement? Probably not.
Mm.
But I think this is, again, one of the areas where you want to be selective. So I would say if you want to supplement, that's a reasonable gray area. So again, I kind of think of three buckets, right? There's the stuff that makes sense. If you can measure it and you know you're deficient and you can supplement into the optimal range, do it, right? And then there's a small group of things. I would put a daily multivitamin in here too, that perfectly reasonable, but I would not want to have 50 things in that bucket, right?
Yep.
I would maybe have 3 or 4 or 5, right? And then there's the stuff that I would just, at least for now, stay away from until we get more data. I think asking for, you know, you said, I think you sort of paraphrased my stance as don't supplement if we don't have rock solid data. I wouldn't go quite that firm, but I would say you want to have at least some reasonable evidence that this is going to be beneficial for you before you take the supplement. Again, in part because we don't know what all the interactions are going to be.
Yep. Right?
And every supplement pill is going to have other stuff in there.
Yep.
And you don't know what it is. And so you can try your best to buy from a reputable manufacturer. You know, if you're independently wealthy, you can do independent testing to see what else is in there. But the average person isn't going to be able to do that, right? And so when you start adding on more and more and more and more filler, right, you don't know the point where it actually becomes problematic for you. The last thing I'll say, and this is where I think that the companion animal space is behind the human space. I think in people, we have a variety of pretty good biomarkers that we can use to get a feel for your overall health status, right? Mm-hmm. Comprehensive blood work, imaging, things like that. That isn't really done in companion animals yet. I think there are people starting to think about how we do that. Certainly in the Dog Aging Project, we're collecting a variety of different types of data, but we're not there yet. And so in people, you can often get a feel if something you're doing is moving your system out of what I would call homeostasis, right? The optimal state that it mm-hmm. should be in. And even if you don't know what it is, you can try different things to see if you can move the biomarkers back where we want them to be. We don't really have that level of resolution in companion animals yet. We'll get there, but we don't really have that yet. And so, again, it's interesting. I'm starting to see companies follow suit for, you know, I don't know if you know Function Health, but they sell blood tests to people, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to see companies talk about doing direct-to-consumer blood tests to dogs and cats and pet owners. And I have mixed feelings about that because I don't know that veterinarians are going to know what to do with that data. And I don't think we have the data set yet in companion animals to know what it means. If you get a blood test with 200 different biomarkers on it for your dog,
yeah,
we don't know what most of that means, right? So hopefully in the next few years, we'll get more good biomarker data in companion animals, but I don't think we have it right now.
Yeah, that makes sense. What I do now is, just for the people who are listening, because I talk about my health all the time because I think it's important for, because that's how I learned how to get healthier.
Yeah.
Or at least
feel, me too.
Or feel better.
Yeah.
Is people like you and me, they listen, they go, okay, that's maybe I can do this. What I did is I went to a naturopath doctor. He ordered a full test of all my blood stuff. He educated me about the methylation system, which is essentially, I mean, you could speak to this, but it's essentially how everything kind of works together. And the way that he puts it up on the screen is basically all the gears work with each other. And if one thing is deficient or if one thing is off, it kind of stops the whole system. So it'd be like a good engine running and operating together, or a good team. And so I did another test. I did two other tests. It's the one that you have to pee and spit in something for like 2 days. It measures your
and cortisol test.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Cortisol, all that stuff. And then I did a genetic methylation test as well. So my naturopath, I go to him twice a year, do a full panel, pulls all the things that he needs to see. And what he does is he tells me, to what you said earlier, is what I'm optimal in and making sure I'm not deficient in anything. Because if I'm deficient in something, then that's where this wheel and methylation won't spin this wheel right, which is, it could be why you have anxiety, or it could be why you're not producing serotonin or melatonin, and it really all works together. I know that it's much bigger than what I'm saying, but that's the way I just, because I'm just your average Joe who just felt like I wasn't optimized, right? And so I went to a naturopath doctor, which is kind of like more of a holistic type approach where they try to be proactive instead of reactive, right? And so I went to him, he ordered the test, I did the test, and he made sure that I was optimal in all the ranges, so all the vitamins, all the supplements. And so, and then I'm also cold plunging, which has helped my mental state of mind significantly. I know that there's a lot of physical pros to doing the cold plunger, cold exposure in general. But what I've noticed significantly with my own health is just more clarity, less anxiety, less depression and sadness that can kind of creep in. And that's been amazing. And then with my, I have a cold plunge and then I have a sauna right next to it. And that's been really good for my sleep as well.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm doing.
That makes perfect sense. And just a couple things that I would riff on there. So one is, this is exactly what we're doing at OptiSpan, is trying to figure out, you know, what of all of the things that you could do in the medical space give the biggest bang for the buck, and then how do we scale that? So can we give kind of best-in-class, evidence-based approaches to medical providers who want to do this kind of medicine. So you mentioned you've got a naturopathic doctor. Sounds like he's doing all of the right things, but it's a very uneven playing field out there. So if it would be hard for the average person to go find a really good doctor in this space. And again, it's interesting because many of the naturopaths have sort of rebranded in the last 18 months as longevity doctors, because it's
a
new buzzword. Yeah. So all I'll say is it's very uneven. There are some really good ones. There are some really, really bad ones. There are some people, you know, who are upselling different diagnostics and different tests that you don't need. And nobody has really created a really solid 80-20. Like, where do you get 80% of the benefits if you could do everything for 20% of the cost? I'd like to get to 90-10. I think we can. So anyways, that's what we're trying to build. And in the foundation is what you said. It is the comprehensive blood work. I think we've got a pretty good idea of what to measure. And again, I don't want to derail this podcast, but we could go deep on that another time if you want to. Imaging, so I think body composition, DEXA, is something everybody should do. For sure. Physical assessments. So I don't know if you know your VO2 max and your strength and agility and all of that stuff. That's important. I sort of think of this in the domain of four pillars of lifestyle: eat, move, sleep, connect. So nutrition, exercise, sleep quality, and then relationships and mindfulness, right? And that gets to the stress. And stress sort of weaves through all of this.
Yeah.
So you mentioned sauna, cold plunge. I would put those more in the, they work really well for some people. If it works for you, great. Is sauna going to give everybody a significant bump in health or mortality? Probably not, but for some people it's great and there's really not a lot of downside as long as you don't fall asleep in your sauna. And that can happen. I know somebody who, believe it or not, I know somebody who lost an arm.
What?
Because he passed out in the sauna on his arm. His wife found him and fortunately didn't die. So everything has risks. So
jeez.
Don't sauna alone or don't fall asleep with the sauna.
Whoa.
Regardless, I love sauna. I've done cold plunge. I like doing cold plunge. I don't have a cold plunge at home. But I would put that in the bucket of, you know, that's second level. The foundation is really understand where your health is at, get your lifestyle factors dialed in. And then if you need medications, get those dialed in too. And so proactively use FDA-approved medicines that work to prevent diabetes or prevent heart disease. And we know enough now to do that. So you're still pretty young, but when you get to be my age, right, you can be doing everything right and you still are going to go down the path of pre-diabetes, and we can prevent that. And so knowing how to use those medicines to keep people healthy. I think what you said is super important. Proactive rather than reactive. Mm-hmm. That's where healthcare needs to go.
Yeah.
And the more people we can get thinking that way, the better.
Yeah.
Because really this has to start with the average person. The patients, the public,
that's right,
has to demand this.
Yeah, that's right. Because what I've seen too is, you know, going to him, he tells me all the time, he says, man, he goes, I can detect all these things that people are now struggling with early, years early, if they were to just do one blood test a year, which is the most minimal you could do, so he can detect, like, whoa, this, because he tells me all the time, like, we want to, because he shows me the graph of where you want to be optimal and making sure, hey, because I had a, you know, for an example, I use this vitamin B, I think a B12 or something, and it's just like a pump from Symbiotica, and he said, your vitamin B is a little high, let's just half that, like, so he really plugs me in and diagnoses, and then every single time I go there, he does... he puts the finger and then my toe, and he does my hydration. He does my muscle mass. He's doing all these things, and he's telling me, he's like, because my wife does it as well, and he's like, if more people did this, and it's not a lot of money. I mean, to go see him, it's like $100, you know. But he sends out the tests, which is a couple $100.
Right.
But even if you did it once a year, you can see on the chart, like, hey, this is your white cells or whatever, super high.
Yep.
This, you should look at this, because he said that he's detected cancer, he's detected all these different things. And one thing I want to say before we take off is, and this may be not a couple minute conversation, but I did do some intravenous NAD because I was doing the research, and essentially in layman's terms, it's NAD goes in and rebuilds your cells at a cellular level, right? So as we age, what causes us to age is our cells breaking down and deteriorating, and NAD goes in and helps repair them. Is that correct? might be a loaded
question. I would say that's an oversimplification. So here's what I would say. So NAD is one of a handful of molecules in our cells that are sort of central to many, many different chemical reactions, including energy production, right? Mm. And so at that level, yeah, NAD is really important. I think where the disconnect between what's actually been shown scientifically and what's kind of out there, you know, in the internet is whether or not NAD levels decline substantially with age and whether or not that's important for health, right? So if, in fact, NAD levels decline with age or with disease, then boosting those NAD levels should be beneficial, right? That's kind of the crux of the argument. The question is whether that really happens. And so what we don't know at this point is for which individuals is NAD deficiency really a problem and whether or not something like an NAD infusion is going to be beneficial for them. What I would say is I am confident that some people, some diseases, Parkinson's disease would be one that I would probably put in this list, are part of the pathology of the disease is dysregulation of NAD metabolism. And in that context, boosting NAD is likely to have beneficial effects. Mm-hmm. NAD infusions sort of give you this very, very acute, very fast rush of NAD.
Oh, man. And it's brutal.
And some people feel great. Some people feel terrible. I've talked to a doc who says that at least for certain patients of his, he sees remarkable outcomes. The vast majority of people that I've talked to don't really seem to get any obvious benefit from NAD infusions. There are other ways you can get NAD. You can take NAD boosters orally. You can take nicotinamide. Again, it's unclear, in my view, whether that's likely to be beneficial net for the average person. And I don't think we really know at an individual level who these things would be good for and who they wouldn't be good for. Like you mentioned the vitamin B. We can measure that.
So you can't measure the NAD levels if you use it.
There are people who will tell you they can measure NAD levels. I mean, it can be done biochemically. It's a little bit of a tricky assay. And when you do that, you're just measuring NAD levels in usually blood, right? And so that's not necessarily going to faithfully report NAD levels in your brain or your kidney or your heart, right? So it's we don't have a great test. And we don't know what the optimal range for NAD is. That's the other thing. Vitamin D, we've got a pretty good idea, more or less, where we want people to land. NAD, we don't really at this point.
Yeah, because that was one of the things is, you know, one of my friends who's into health as well. He's like, yeah, I did NAD. I didn't notice anything. I said, yeah, same. I said, it's so expensive. For those of you who don't know, it's like, you know, what I get is I get like 750, whatever the dosage, or I don't know how they do it, but it's expensive. It's like $800 for an intravenous IV of NAD. And I don't really feel any, because my buddy goes, you're young and you're healthy. Or younger and
that
you're
could
healthy.
Could be part of it, for sure.
So it's hard to measure, you know, because in my head I'm like, yeah, but if it's internally rebuilding cells and on the surface.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the challenge is, right, when you're trying to talk to the general public, people who don't have a PhD or at least an undergrad in biology, you're sort of forced to use those terms like rebuilding cells. But that's obviously an oversimplification. And I think in the case of NAD, that doesn't really capture the reality of the biology. Mm. So this is part of the challenge in this space is there's so much noise out there and much of it has a kernel of truth to it, but it's such an oversimplification of the reality that people get tricked, confused into taking things that we learn after the fact are not beneficial and in some cases harmful. I'll give you a classic example in the longevity space. Have you heard of resveratrol?
No.
Okay, so resveratrol is this molecule found in red wine. About, I don't know, 15 years ago, a Harvard scientist, based on garbage science, made the claim that resveratrol slows aging, increases lifespan, and that accounts for the benefits from red wine, if there are any benefits from red wine. So, of course, the wine industry loved this and convinced a lot of people they should start drinking red wine for health benefits. And the resveratrol supplement industry exploded. This particular scientist started a company.
Sure.
Sold it to GlaxoSmithKline for $750 million.
Oh, boy.
And they shut the program down 6 months after buying it when they realized that the results were garbage.
Did he get sued, the countersuit?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the inside details. And you can still go online and find claims that resveratrol is a longevity supplement.
Right.
There was a, let me just finish. There was a meta-analysis, I think last year or the year before, that looked at a couple hundred studies. So all of the studies that they could collect in the published literature on resveratrol and longevity, and they asked, what is the average effect? And the average effect was zero. No effect on lifespan across dozens, if not hundreds, of studies. And because of the way science works, there's a publication bias towards positive results. So that means there were probably many studies that never got published where resveratrol shortened lifespan. The net effect is probably lowering lifespan. And yet 15 years later, you will still find supplement companies selling this as a longevity drug, even though it's the most debunked longevity supplement ever.
That's insane.
So it takes a long time to clean up the misinformation is what I'm saying. So I think people are well served to at least have at least a dose of skepticism when people are claiming that this is going to slow aging or keep you from getting age-related diseases or make you live longer. Right now, there's really nothing in the supplement industry that I would say convincingly is going to have a positive effect on the biology of aging or your longevity. There are some things that might, that are probably relatively safe. You could put NAD boosters in that class. I'd put alpha-ketoglutarate in that class. Maybe urolithin A. There's a handful of supplements that are out there that might have some benefits for longevity or at least age-related biology, but it's a pretty small set.
Yeah. All right. Where can people find all the information about the project? And I know that you said earlier in the podcast about how people can basically sign up to be part of the study.
Yeah.
So if you want to plug that.
Yeah. So the website is dogagingproject.org. And as I said, any dog, any size, any breed, any age eligible to participate in the observational study. If your dog is over 7 years old and 40 to 110 pounds, you could be eligible for the rapamycin clinical trial if you're interested. All of that can be found on the Dog Aging Project website. Daniel, Katie, and I have started a nonprofit, 501c3, called the Dog Aging Institute. If people want to support the project or science to improve health in companion animals in general, you can check out dogaginginstitute.org. And I have a podcast called the OptiSpan Podcast, where I talk about all sorts of stuff longevity related, some of it in dogs, a lot of it in people, a lot of it having to do with the science of longevity. So if you're interested in that, I'd encourage you to check it out.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Matt Kaeberlein.
You got it.
Because people want to say Kaeberlein, but it's Kaeberlein. Thank you so much for joining us. And for those of you who are listening, I'll put all those links, if you're driving or running or doing all the things that I usually do when I listen to podcasts, I'll put all those links in the descriptions. You guys can click on them when you have time. Thank you so much for coming on. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.